Hey there, welcome to SaaS Inbound Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business success. So today with me is Christian, CEO and co-founder of Learn.xyz, mobile microlearning powered by AI. As I think I should skip like this powered by AI thing because everything's powered by AI these days. So it's just a given. But yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, we were first in the learning space, at least. No, but it is interesting, right? Like AI becomes a commodity and essentially you don't have to say anymore. It's kind of implied. But then on the other hand, you know, for many people, it's not implied. And especially the companies that we sell to, you know, like they use software solutions that don't have any AI. They still write courses by hand. They have to upload their videos that they produce for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so sometimes we in the bubble of like SaaS people also think that AI is completely normal, but for the grow, like most people, it is still not. And so that's, I think we still have a little bit of time to go and we still can say it's powered by AI. Yeah, I had this like last week at a conference, like obviously it's powered by AI. And then the person at the booth was like, what do you mean with obviously? But we sometimes think that everything is obvious when we live here in San Francisco. Sure.
Yeah. Get out of that LinkedIn bubble. Like I was reading a post the other day where, it was also about the fact that, okay, we're like on LinkedIn, we read about all these tech bros, you know, ditching Google. Like what is Google even? Like when there is perplexity, Google is old news. And no, Google is still growing. Because, well, you know, there are other people who are not in tech and who have never heard about Perplexity in the first place. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I asked that question to one of my podcast guests, Richard Socher, who is the founder of You.com. And I asked him why they are not more loud, right? Like they basically have this search engine that is a good replacement for Google, but they now also pivoted away basically into this B2B space because they were like, you know, like Google pays Apple $20 billion a year or something to be the default search engine. In Europe, there was like for a small period of time, this option to change the default when you would basically set up your iPhone. But then, you know, Google is still the brand that everyone knows. And so it's really hard to compete against them. And so that's why, you know, that for most people, it's not going away. But I have the feeling it's changing. Like even my mom, she's using ChatGPT now every day, right? And she's 70. And she just understood like suddenly there's this like person I can even talk to. And she calls it like, you know, her friend, ChatGPT, she talks to about all kinds of things. So I would say it is slowly changing. And if I was in Google's shoes, I'd be a little bit afraid.
Yeah, that's true. I even like my son goes to school and they share photos from the classroom. And I was looking through them at some point, there was ChatGPT on the screen. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, they're six, but thank you. Now they know what ChatGPT is. So yeah, that's pretty cool. Anyway, before we jump into the whole AI and learn.xyz, let's learn about you because you're coming from Germany. You're one of the shareholders of OMR. It's a great story. So maybe a bit of your background first.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I'm from Hamburg originally, studied in Cologne, went back to Hamburg afterwards, and I met my co-founders from OMR because I was always in this conference game, like during high school and during college, and I always loved to organize things. For me, this was always this hack, like if you are the person that organizes something, everyone knows you. And so that was always my thought of like, hey, this is actually the best way how you get to know people. And then in Hamburg, a common friend said, oh, you should meet Philip because Philip is organizing this thing, or he's starting to organize this thing called OMR, Online Marketing Rockstars, back in the day. And you should team up. And so we teamed up. And then I also worked at a startup during that time, a tech company actually here from Silicon Valley. And I was one of the first employees in the Hamburg office. And then after like 2 or 3 years, we got acquired by Adobe. And Adobe then basically made the offer to move to San Francisco. And I took that chance 12 years ago. And I remember this very vividly because I told Philip Westermeyer back in the days, that I will be moving to San Francisco. And back then, OMR was really small, right? We had maybe 3,000 guests at the time at the main festival. We didn't have any employees. It was only like us four founders. And so he was like, this is as if you die. And that was like a very drastic statement. But for me, this was actually perfect because I suddenly had two time zones to work in. So I moved here in 2012, 2013. And I had the chance basically to work during the day at a big tech job here in Silicon Valley. And then during the night and early mornings, I was able to work for the German market. And so having basically two jobs helped me to be like a remote person from day one. And then we started to hire people, right? Like all the things that I used to do. I used to be responsible for the event orga and marketing and sales. And so we would just hire people that were much better in those things than I was anyways. And then over time, more and more people joined OMR, of course, and I was able to step a little bit back. And then since 2020, I got out entirely. And in between, I changed my jobs here also in Silicon Valley. So I was always a product person, basically made my first career in product management here and worked then for 6 years at LinkedIn. And then at some point, I was just like, you know, I have to get into like starting a company, because if you live in Silicon Valley and you are not working in some startup or you're not working in the startup ecosystem, then you somehow miss out. I had this podcast that I recently restarted where I interviewed other Germans in the Bay Area. And one person that I interviewed, he told me, Christian, look, if you just hang out in these big tech companies, you really like don't even realize what is going on. And so that was one of those moments where I was like, yeah, I really have to start something. And then there were some lucky incidences. Actually, one quick story. I'm already talking too much again, but one quick story. One of my best friends, he was like, Christian, I give you $100,000 if you just think about starting a new company. You know, you don't have to quit LinkedIn. You kind of just hire a designer, hire maybe an engineer to build some prototypes. You can do this like on the side. And then maybe, you know, you eventually quit, but like just get started. And I first said no to him because, you know, we were pregnant with our second child and I thought this is the wrong timing. And then he had me talk to his investment manager, and Maria then said to me in the call, Christian, why do you want to be a director of product when you can be the CEO of your own company? And that sentence was basically engraved in my head in that moment. I was like, yes, you're so right. And yeah, then I found my co-founder and we started a company, and from there, it started basically to you know, work for myself for the first time actually in my life, 100%, because all my other entrepreneurial ventures so far were always kind of side jobs, right? Like OMR, I never was a full-time employee. I always did this on the side. And so yeah, this company that we do today is what we basically then did full-time.
Okay, that's interesting. One of the things I wanted to ask you is just also about the change coming from Hamburg, which is now, I mean, we do events there from time to time, and you've been to one, and now it's quite an active SaaS scene. But back then, 10 years ago, I would assume that was like a drastic mindset change as well, going from Hamburg to San Francisco. And I was wondering, like, how did you take that?
Yeah, I mean, look, back then, San Francisco or Silicon Valley was kind of this remote place that not that many people talked about, right? Like there were these few big tech companies, of course, but I actually came here after my college degree, after my bachelor's, the first time just on vacation, like a lot of people do, you know, this typical California trip where you drive around the state and explore all the sites. And then I was sitting with my back then girlfriend, today wife, under the bridge here, and we were looking at the water and we're like, this is a city we could envision living at some point. And then, you know, a few years later that happened, it wasn't like planned to be here forever. We thought, oh, this is a great adventure. We moved there for 2 years and then we come back and then I do OMR full time or something, you know, because we were growing quite heavily. And so my idea was always like, eventually I do OMR full time once we had a size where we can actually afford employees. And the mindset, I mean, I always say that also in Hamburg or in Berlin or other cool cities in Germany, we also just cook with water, right? So I wouldn't necessarily say that that was so different, at least at that time, because I didn't really work in Silicon Valley, as I mentioned earlier, right? Like I worked at these big tech companies, and so they are kind of the same almost everywhere in the world. But I think I missed out quite a lot on like these innovations, and like I didn't join companies that were like growing from 10 to, you know, 10,000 employees over a couple of months or years. But I joined companies that were already pretty big. And they also grew and it was great and their stock price increased. And so this was all great. But for me, this mindset shift wasn't actually so big because again, I didn't join the startup world. Now I see this completely different. I think there's a massive change compared to like what's going on in Germany and what we see here in Silicon Valley today.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. So, okay, let's get to learn.xyz. And yeah, you started it. Well, why in the first place? Like, why that? And why did you go B2C?
Yeah. So it's kind of funny. So why that company? So the company started, as I mentioned, because someone told me you should really like start your own company. And then we were like, okay, what do we do? And OMR came out of this idea of education, right? We taught people online marketing. This was actually the first thing that we did. We did these seminar series and would teach people about online marketing. And my parents are teachers. My grandparents were teachers. Same with my co-founder. And we thought, like, why don't do something in education? And we were basically just looking at what opportunities are out there. And the first product that we actually built wasn't even what we have today at all. It was a crypto education platform because we thought, you know, like there is this kind of upswing in crypto and more people might be interested in how all of this works. And why not start with some kind of vertical and then eventually do other things as well? This was pre-AI, right? Like we didn't know that these models were that powerful. ChatGPT wasn't out there. And after maybe 3 or 4 months into that, we realized that we didn't really like the crypto market. You know, the, most of the people that we engaged with were just not what, you know, our beliefs into, you know, things were, like a lot of like how to get rich quick. And it wasn't really about learning. People just came to basically get like some tokens and try to scam us actually. And then we had some users that really liked the product that we had built, the way how you learn. And they asked us, like, can you like maybe teach us other things other than just Web3 and crypto related content? And so we started writing courses. And so this was the summer of 2022. So remember in the fall of 2022, in December, ChatGPT launched. And so in that summer, we basically started writing courses by hand and would basically create like 1 or 2 courses a week. And we realized after maybe 4 weeks, like this is not scalable. Like how should we ever make a sustainable business? Like we thought about hiring content writers somewhere remote. We did, but that wasn't really good either. And so we, you know, learned from friends that there are these AI tools and we got early access to the APIs from OpenAI before ChatGPT was released and basically started to develop this tool where you could ask a question and then a course would come out. And we had this idea, okay, there's Duolingo out there where you learn languages. Why not have something where you can learn everything with the power of AI? And so the first product that we really launched then was essentially like a fun learning app where you build your streak, where you get points, where you have leaderboards and build basically a consumer learning app. And then ChatGPT launched, and that was just the perfect timing for us because with the launch of ChatGPT, there was so much buzz around all these new AI tools that were popping up and we were everywhere in the news and every AI newsletter that popped up in the beginning of 2023 would report about us. And we got very quickly to about 100,000 users and like within 4 or 5 weeks. And so we were like, okay, how do we grow now to like 1 million users? And then we actually massively failed and it dropped down to about 5,000 users again, weekly actives. And then we emailed all of these users and it's like, why are you still here? Because we couldn't find out why no one would continue to use the product because we got really good feedback, but people would just not come back and retention wasn't that great. And so and some people said, we really like the product. Do you have a B2B version? And first we were like, no, we're a B2C product. We really want to grow this B2C business. But after another 2 or 3 months, so this was last year, we basically made this decision. Okay, well, I guess on the B2B side is the demand for this product. So over the summer of last year, we basically built this B2B version out and launched that in November. And now have clients that pay us for this product. And so long story short, in the end, why did we build this? We had an initial hypothesis and then we listened to our users, right? Like we basically have hundreds and hundreds of feedback sessions with them. And even with the product that we launched in November and what we have today, we have a release every single week. And so we listen and we talk to our clients to figure out what are the things that really are pain points for them. So we fix them and iterate super, super fast. And that way we found some kind of product market fit.
I'm just wondering why B2B, because you compared it to Duolingo, and I'm not sure, maybe probably Duolingo works somehow with B2B option as well. No, it doesn't?
No, okay. No. I mean, they have like as a benefit thing they sell, you know, like some companies give their employees Duolingo for free. But yeah, it's not a B2B product per se.
Right, right. I think that's exactly what I meant. But what you're describing, again, I'm just thinking like I would probably just use it as me, as a consumer. Do you know, like, what was the ask? Like, why the companies were interested in that?
Yeah. So look, if you analyze all existing learning solutions, starts with LinkedIn Learning and Udacity and Udemy, and then there are these, there's this joke I always make, I think they're called, I don't know actually what their name is, Placebo or something. Placebo, this is the name. It's an Italian company that is like learning software. I always call them Placebo, the place where you don't learn actually, because this name always resonates with me so much. But anyways, no matter who you ask, everyone basically says, oh, I really hate my corporate learning. It's like so cringy. It's bad. Like we had this very initial outreach from a very big consulting firm and we took the call and he was like, look, people take screenshots of the questions and the questionnaires and everything. And then they send them in private WhatsApp groups around so that no one really has to read and everyone can just go through the screenshots and very quickly answer the questions. And then it's massively expensive to create the content. And takes forever. And so all of these learning and development people were really frustrated, right? Like, A, the software that they implement, people hate. It's very expensive to create the content. And then in the end, people get phished anyways because they didn't pay attention of, you know, the course on cybersecurity. And so why people wanted this is because suddenly people like using the learning product. And we see this in the engagement rates, right? Like, I mean, yes, we can create the content super fast and AI does all of that job for you. You connect your knowledge and within seconds you have courses about any topic you want and it can be hyper personalized to your use case for your company, very detailed. And there's a whole range of editing functionalities in the product. But what we think and what also our clients tell us, what the killer feature is that suddenly people learn because they like the product. I mean, they suddenly love like corporate learning. And that almost sounds like a paradox to a lot of these learning development people that someone might really like the product. And we see this with clients. People do on average around 30 lessons per employee per month because they all keep their streak and they use it not only for the mandatory courses, but they prepare for client meetings. They ask questions like, oh, how do I manage a work conflict with an employee? Or how do I run a good one-on-one with someone or something, right? Like, so they basically use the tool to inspire. And yes, you might say, oh, I can just ask these questions in ChatGPT or Perplexity or elsewhere. And people do that as well. But then they don't build their streak and then they don't have points and their manager can't see that they asked a smart question. And then someone else might take your course and you get a high five and you feel just a little bit good about that. And these are all these like little tricks that you can like do in building great like consumer kind of features, but put them actually out there for B2B usage that like brought us to this place where people seem to like the product. And yeah, we're excited about that.
All right. So the sales process went B2B, but the product is very much still B2C to get people hooked.
Yeah, I mean, the end experience, there are similarities. Obviously, we evolved also over time. But yes, the end product still feels like a B2C app. And there's this little octopus that, you know, his or her one name is Lumi. Exactly. Here, this one, yeah. And we try to make it really lovable, you know. And and then, of course, there is a desktop environment where you manage your users and you have these groups that you assign content to. And then you have editing functionality. And which is also, by the way, a fun story. Like, users said, we really want to edit the content. And of course, you have to edit the content, but only 4% of the content that our AI creates is being edited because we just spend so much time on making the content quality really good that there's almost no need anymore to do that. So yeah, people seem to like it. And once a user is activated, and for us, activation means, you know, like a certain amount of people are in the product, they take a certain amount of courses, then it usually flies. Like I got this screenshot from one of our pilot clients And they were 4 days into the pilot. And he sent me a screenshot of the leaderboard. And the number one person already took 92 courses. And the only thing he sent to me was like, what the fuck? It's like, in a way, it's like people learn too much here. We have another client that said, can you turn off like some of the gamifications? This is distracting people from work. And I think this is a good problem to have, right? Like if you implement a software and people really use it, and then you can dial down a few things. And so we are building these controls for admins to say, okay, maybe people are not allowed to create their own courses. So they can only take the stuff that is being assigned to them or what their managers create or something like that.
Yeah, definitely a good problem to have. But I also wanted to ask, because, you know, pivoting from B2C to B2B, but still kind of preserving that unique personalized experience, how at the same time has your marketing or sales process changed with that pivot?
No, of course, it's completely different, right? Honestly, we are trying to figure this out, what the best process is. But when we were a consumer app, we would like hit TikTok and Instagram. We would run around actually with these costumes. We basically have these live, like huge costumes that you can, like our mascot essentially, right? And so we would go to all these conferences and places where people would hang out that we thought might be curious and to download an app. So we would go to university campuses. We would go, I mean, we did a lot of things that also didn't work. Like we thought, oh, you know, there are all these tourists in San Francisco. They're just standing in lines and they wait until they can take the cable car. What a great place to just learn about the cable car and the history. And so we created these little postcards with stamps on it. And then we went with a costume there and we thought, you know, there are hundreds of people standing in line. Like easily we get like hundreds of signups from like 1 hour of work. Like not even one person would take the postcard from us. They were like, no, I don't want to like take anything from a stranger. So it didn't work at all. So many things also didn't work. I mean, after all, the consumer product didn't work, right? Like we couldn't find a way to get this to scale. And on the B2B side, we are trying a lot of things. This is from outreach on LinkedIn, from going to conferences, from being in podcasts, from doing like fun things at trade shows. So for example, next week we go to a trade show in San Diego and the booth price was like $10,000 or something. And we were there last year. We didn't even buy a ticket. We were just hanging outside because San Diego is so nice and people are just hanging out by the water and all the meetings actually happen in this outside area. And last year I saw this little art gallery. And so I made the connection. They said, hey, can I rent your art gallery next year? And they were like, yeah, sure. How much do you want? And they were like, it's $1,000 for a day. And so now we have basically this art gallery with this porch in front of this big plaza where all the VCs are sitting and all the learning and development people and have their meetings. And we have a booth outside in like plain sight. So I think it's one of the most important things for anyone that goes to a trade show. Like, how do you stand out, right? Like if you just have your booth next to 30 other people, like, I mean, yes, maybe you're lucky and someone comes by, but you have to grab the attention from people and you have to be loud, but not by like screaming, of course, but like by doing something fun. And we try that, but honestly, I mean, we're really early on, right? Like we didn't talk about metrics yet, but we have 20 clients right now. So the product launched in November and I'm trying to get more and we're figuring out ways, and some things work and others don't. And I started my own podcast again where I interview other Germans. Actually, I have this very fun way of attracting customers. So as a little side project, I run the House of AI, which is a cool co-working space here in San Francisco. So I always say it's like the co-working space for the most ambitious founders in San Francisco. So there are about 20 founders that work from our space here. And a lot of German delegations come here to San Francisco and Silicon Valley to basically visit, you know, and get inspired and learn about the mindset here. And so they come by and it's fantastic because all of these people are CEOs, head of digital transformation, and they want to get inspired. And I happen to have a good story to tell. And they come by House of AI. I give like 30, 40, 50 minutes of presentation and then Q&A. They pay some money to come here because obviously there's work for me. And then some of them become clients afterwards. So I always make this joke that we have a positive CAC because basically people pay money to us in order to become then clients. But it's a great way to get into a completely different audience that we would have never guessed before. We're like hidden champions in the German market. It's kind of a little bit stupid as a San Francisco startup to tackle the German market. but it works for us. And then on top of that, I do this podcast where I interview other Germans here in the Bay Area. And that's the exact same story. People, head of digital transformation, CEOs, they listen to this podcast and then it's presented by LearnXYZ. And we are just in episode 2. So the third episode will come out this weekend, but a couple of thousand people listen to it. And so we already got some inbounds, people try out the product and hopefully from there we can scale that. But that's the early hustle, right? Like you try out all these different things. And I kind of don't want to do these things like, oh, just bombard a million people by email with Clay or Apollo, or I don't want to set up these, at least not now, set up these like automated phone calling things. I want to find other ways, at least this early on when I'm the only salesperson, to attract some really good clients that kind of, you know, fall in love with the product and then go from there. And obviously we have like reviews now on OMR reviews and those things. And yeah, there are many things that you can do. And yeah, it's not very structured yet, I would say.
Okay. I mean, nothing is if you're what, 4-5 months into a new venture. But yeah, okay. Shout out to you then with the House of AI. We're also going to host our event at your co-working space. So yeah, if you're a SaaS founder listening to this, that's where we are, May 16th.
Yeah, come by. If you need a desk, you can also talk to me. No, it's really nice. You know why I actually started House of AI? The reason was, I mean, obviously we need an office space and we are an early stage startup, so we didn't have as much budget for a nice space. And I like really nice spaces and I wanted to have this OMR feeling as an office space. And so I asked a bunch of my founder friends like, hey, would you rent a desk for me? And 8 or so said yes immediately. And so we started with, you know, we are 5. And so with 5 of us and 8 of them, and then it was a good split of how we could split the rent. But it turned into so much more. And the best part of House of AI is that it increases the serendipity of Silicon Valley that I love to talk about, right? Like, how do you run into interesting people by accident, essentially? And because all of these founders, and they're 20 now, they bring their friends, their founder friends, they bring in VCs. We actually have one VC that also has kind of a ride to be downstairs. We have this event space downstairs and then people work upstairs and they bring other interesting people in again. And so whenever you go downstairs to have a coffee, there's someone sitting there and you kind of have a small interaction. And for me, you know, I'm not working in some small little shitty startup with 5 people, but I work in a place where they're always like 20, 25 people that bring a lot of interesting folks together. And there are just all these like nice interactions that happen through that. And while I can't measure the output of that perfectly fine just yet, it makes you like, and everyone that works here really, really happy to be in this place rather than some, you know, like WeWork that doesn't have any community and like no personality to it. And so that's for me the main reason why we do this, actually, because of the community aspect.
That's pretty cool. And I think like keeping it small is also very important. Like that's why our events are also very small. Like, I mean, absolutely. In Silicon Valley, I think putting together an event where it's like 100, 200 people would be absolutely possible. But then it's just going to be like another conference-y feeling. And you would like have to stay in line to talk to a person that you want to talk to. But if you're 40, then, you know, it just kind of happens. And like you said, it's a bit of a serendipity feeling, which really works.
Yeah, I always say when people ask me what kind of events they should organize, I always also tell them, don't make it too big. Rather have like a good dinner. Or the latest thing that I really like are these breakfast sessions that one VC that I know now does sometimes here. So they basically invite like a star speaker, like some CHRO or some, you know, like CRO or COO from like a successful company. And then they invite some of their portfolio CEOs. So really small group, like 8-10 people around our big wooden table downstairs. And then they serve really nice breakfast. There's a little kind of talk from the star exec from this company. And then there's a Q&A session afterwards. And then people go to work at 10 and everyone got to know like 6-7 other interesting people. They got some really like cool key insight maybe. And then they go back to work rather than leaving work early at like 4 p.m. And then, you know, you kind of go to yet another networking event and then you just kind of network and you talk to some people and then maybe you talk to like like the three people that were a little awkward and you don't really get anything out of it. And so I think they're very, like a lot of very creative ways of how to like host much more creative events. Like what you guys do, right? Like I remember last year when we did the boat tour and then afterwards the dinner, that was like for me the perfect size of the event where you almost had the chance to talk to everyone that was there.
Yeah. Do smaller events like Christian, and bear in mind OMR is 75,000 people.
Well, yeah, both have their advantages. The beauty in these huge events actually for me now is all the other things that are also happening, right? Because everyone is in town. And so you have actually these smaller events around OMR that make it really worthwhile for me. And then, of course, you have some really cool content pieces that you can also go to. By the way, huge shout out to everyone to already like plan the attendance now, like which events you want to go to, what timetable, like what speaking slots you want to go to. So the more time in you invest upfront, the better also the experience will be for you. Because I sometimes get this like feedback from people where they say, oh, OMR is so big, like I don't want to go there anymore because I don't see anyone. It's just too like not personal. You know, you have to put some time in, like with everything, right? Like you have to invest a little bit into something and then you also get more out.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Okay, can I have a little rant about OMR?
Of course, please.
Just one.
Very small. Go for it.
But I went last year, and yes, it's huge, and I got lost a couple of times, but that's just me. I'm geographically challenged. But yeah, one thing, why are all the headlines in English? But when you go there, it's in German. It's like, I was like, why?
What do you mean with headlines? The
like
speaking?
Like the title of the talk would be in English. And you would be like, oh, that's wonderful. I'm not speaking German, not even a little. And then I go and it's in German.
Okay, so two things. One, there should always be a little flag to each talk in the program so you know which language the talk is in. And then also, usually there are translation devices available for everyone,
oh, really?
At least in the big stages. So you can always look for these, like, this live translation, basically. So we have these people that sit in the back in these little phone booths and they listen to what is being talked about on stage and then live translate it. I mean, I think this is also one of those things that will be solved with AI very quickly. I mean, actually already should work today. I don't even know if we still do this, but you can get these headsets and then you have to basically pay $10 that you get back or euros that you get back, something like that. But there is a solution for that for sure. Not with every masterclass and everything, of course, but like on all the big stages, there is translation.
Okay. All right. Now I know. Well, not coming this year, prioritizing the US, but maybe next one.
Okay.
Let's see. Thank you. But okay, I have another question because you raised $4.5 million for urine.xyz. And I was wondering, because, you know, we're also coming with this event and with SaaS Group, the priority or like kind of the best case scenario was always attracting bootstrap companies to us and buying bootstrap companies. And I was wondering, like, is it even possible in San Francisco?
So first of all, I have to correct. It wasn't 4.5, it was 4 million, but just so that no one says, oh, he's lying. But anyways, I think it is possible to bootstrap a company if you had some exit before in your life. And I happen to not have an exit that would bring me into a position where I could just, you know, not take a salary for a while. And that's just a reality, right? Like I have two kids and they're both in school and, you know, you have a house and a mortgage or a rent or something. And so immediately your expenses, especially once you have kids, go into like 5-digit territories. You can't even do anything about it, right? Like you have like $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 a month is just very normal And that's, it's of, especially if you live in Germany, that sounds crazy. And it is crazy. But that's just the reality of living in San Francisco. And if, that was, for me, also the reason why I went this route of fundraising, because, you know, I don't want to change my, I mean, I want to be a founder, but I also don't want to change my lifestyle too much. You know, of course, we turned back our expenses and we don't go on crazy holidays for the last 2 years. And we limit basically those things. Like when you work in these big tech companies and you easily make $500,000-$700,000 a year, which is really normal in these big tech companies, at least at the time, you don't really need to think about it anymore, right? You just buy that new gadget that comes out and that, oh, there's a new iPhone, a new Pixel phone, you just buy it because these expenses become almost meaningless for people. And yeah, it's it sounds crazy, I know, but yeah, I think that's why it's really hard to bootstrap a company. But I think there's one big difference now is that more and more founders just take very little money on, you know, talking like 1-2 million in this age of AI now, where they get to product market fit much, much quicker. They need to hire way less people. They make revenues way faster. And so there are no follow-on rounds as much anymore. You know, a lot of people only raise something from the accelerator, maybe a million afterwards or two. And then they run with it and they try to become profitable. And so then it's not entirely bootstrapped, but as long as you still have the majority of your company, it almost feels like it, right? Like as long as you don't have to give away a board seat and you have full control of your company, it feels like a bootstrapped thing anyway, even though, of course, there's some money in the bank. You have some investor updates that you need to write and those things. But they're also really helpful, right? Like they help you with introductions to clients and talent and all kinds of things. And so, yeah. But it is, I think it is much harder to bootstrap in San Francisco than it would be, you know, somewhere like in Hamburg or in Berlin even.
Yeah. That was one of the other points that I wanted to ask you about. It's just like, what is the biggest advantage? Like, do you actually have investors who then kind of handhold you a little bit more and introduce you to the right people? Or is it just like completely, hey, that's the money, I believe in you, run with it?
So generally it's the latter. So you get money from the investors, and then at least that's my experience. And also most of the other founders that work out of House of AI, they just got the money and then they can run with it. But what is an advantage to build in San Francisco? I mean, there are many things why you want to be here, right? Like the external factors of the climate and the weather and those things. But those are more jokes, even though it actually affects you massively, right? Like if you constantly have around 20 degrees Celsius or 15 to 20, and you see the sun every single day of the year, essentially. I mean, we have like 330 Sundays in San Francisco, right? And I think Berlin has 150. So it's a big difference. And it makes you just, it brings you in a much better mood. So generally, everyone here has always a better mood. Everyone here seems to be way more motivated, because if you move to San Francisco, you can't just, you know, hang out in a coffee shop and you say, oh, I'm working on this idea. And, you know, like, I won't tell you about it because it's so secret. Like here, everyone works on something. Everyone will tell you. Everyone is seeking feedback. There's this huge hustle culture. And that also changed, honestly, right? Like 3 years ago, pre-AI, I San Francisco was at this verge out of the pandemic where a lot of people left San Francisco, and a lot of people were like, oh, San Francisco is dead, and you know, we want to live now in Miami, or we want to like build, I have this always this joke, like I want to do a blueberry farm somewhere in Portland or something. But San Francisco is back more than ever, right? Like there are hackathons every single weekend, a lot of them. There are events pretty much every evening that you could go to. Everyone that wants to make a living in tech and AI is moving here. And there's just this crazy pool of talent that also on the early stage side, you can draw from, right? Like not everyone gets a job directly at OpenAI or Perplexity or somewhere. And some people also don't want to work there because they are already too big and too advanced, and people want to work on the future in other forms. And so they actually do join early stage startups. And so this talent pool paired with like every single VC essentially has an office here. So you run into these VCs pretty much anywhere you want. It's just such a huge advantage. And the last thing I say, 57% of all venture capital in the US was invested in San Francisco alone last year, right, in 2024. This is up from like 35% the year before that. It's just like, this is where the opportunity is, where the most money is, where the most talented people in this space are. And I see this even that people that start their companies in Germany, they say, hey, I moved to San Francisco because I can just run much faster. And then actually one more thing I want to say, it's also the work ethics here, right? Like my best example here is that essentially San Francisco adopted this 996 work style, which sounds a little crazy for people. You know, this is like this thing that China probably started where you work 6 days a week from 9 to 9. But that's becoming more and more the reality in more companies. For me, it's more like 6 to 6. And then on weekends, I don't actually work 12 hours, but I kind of work a few hours here and there. And then in some evenings, I also work after everyone is in bed. But there's never the thought or the talk of like, oh, I want to only work 4 days a week and I want to have all these benefits. You know, like after all of these big tech companies did these massive layoffs, people also realize, hey, we really need to hustle here. It's not just, you know, what do they say? What do you say in English again? Like honey and milk.
SaaS Group is partnering with SaaS Talk USA, taking place May 13th to 14th in Austin, Texas. This is where heads-down SaaS founders and their teams move their business forward. As a partner, we have 30% discount available to share with our network. Use code SaaSGroup30 in all capital letters and see you there.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to try it. I mean, we're doing this podcast also at, 11 p.m. your time. So thank you for staying that late. But okay, then I just have a couple more questions because I'm still processing what you told me about the pivot from B2C to B2B and, you know, how you're acquiring new customers. And I'm wondering, because you got, in a way, pulled into this by the existing users. And I'm always curious, you know, how many people of those like asking you to build something or asking you to pivot actually convert?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So one of the people that drove us the most was an employee that worked for 30 years, one of the largest consulting firms in the world. And so we had, I don't know how many meetings we had with this person, and he would like get us through the pilot agreement and then through the procurement process. And we would present to all of these execs at that company. And everyone was like, this is unbelievable. No startup ever made it through this procurement and pilot agreement so fast. And then last September, he emails us and says, oh yeah, I just have like some bad news for you probably, but it won't be that bad. But I will be retiring next week. We're like, what the F? If your champion retires or leaves, right? Like this is the biggest risk in any B2B sales process, essentially. So if your champion that you identified is really pushing you forward, you're like your best supporter and friend on the other side. If that person suddenly leaves, a deal is most likely very dead. And the same thing happened, right? Like we had like 2-3 more follow-up conversations with them, but ultimately that deal never came to fruition. So that's probably the biggest failure that we had last year. And because we really focused on this, and we had like a second one that was equally bad as well. But yeah, I generally would say you cannot just build everything that someone asked you for, right? Like you have to identify patterns and why you ideally have multiple early clients so that you can collect similar feedbacks, or you do the same questions to a bunch of your users. And so if you see that 5 of the 10 or 5 of the 20 ask for the same thing, then you can build it, right? And so, you know, you kind of have to weigh all that feedback that comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, that's very interesting. And how has it changed the product or your roadmap, that pivot?
Oh, I mean, yeah, massively, right? Like there is now this difference between the buyer and the user also, because essentially there's someone that decides that they want the product and they have a bunch of requirements. They need, you know, you need to be, I don't know, like SOC 2 compliant suddenly. So there's a lot of work that goes into that, and that's not fun, but you have to do it. Or you need better user management, because it's very obvious that when you have an organization that you need better user management, you need to be able to assign certain courses to certain people. I have actually a great example. The SaaS group also is in a pilot with us right now.
Yes,
and there was plenty of feedback also. And we see how the conversion rate of this pilot will be. We still haven't reached that point. But yeah, you can ask your colleagues of how if and when they will convert to become a full-time client. But yeah, no, the roadmap before you would talk to your most engaged consumer users and they just had the consumer app. And so you would build for that consumer. And now we build very heavily also for these decision makers of what features they need in order to make the decision to buy a product. But when we still to this user that I mentioned earlier that after 3 or 4 days had 92 courses taken, we have a call with them next week actually to understand what makes it so exciting for them. Is it just the price that they get by the end of the month if they're number one on the leaderboard, or do they really enjoy the product so much? What is missing? What can we do? So you have to weigh also that you build not only for the buyer but also for the end user, because ultimately if then the end user again doesn't use the product because something is missing, then what's the point of building the product? And that's our promise, right? If you really use us and really implement us and invite all of your employees to use the product, engagement will skyrocket.
Yeah, absolutely. Yet, like you said, you just have to find your champion with the sales process and also with adoption. All right. Well, just a couple more questions, the usuals here on the podcast. And you told me already about the biggest failure, I guess, at least last year. What was the biggest win?
Generally, so actually this, I continue the story quickly because I think this was the biggest win overall. So we had the September moment, right? Where basically not only this one client, someone retired, but then for another client also turned out that they work for a very large search engine. You can imagine which one. And so this person basically promised us the world, right? They were like, I am the buyer for all sales training AI tools at this company. And you will be making so much money from us. And I am the decision maker. And ultimately, this person wasn't the decision maker. So we had these two major fails that we spent good 3 months on meeting. And I played golf with them. And we invited them for lunch here. We were invited at their offices. We traveled there all kinds of things that you do. And then we were suddenly there in the beginning of October and we didn't have a single client. And that kind of was very crushing in a way, because we spent the summer building this, thinking that these really, really large enterprises would buy us and that would solve and fix our situation. And then we didn't have anyone. And probably 2-3 weeks was kind of this realization that we have to change something. And so in the last week of October, we said, okay, if we can find 10 clients by the end of next month, by the end of November, that pay us and have a monthly recurring revenue from them, then there seems to be basically a success, at least an early success, because then we are onto something. And I told on November 1st everyone in the team that they should stop whatever they were doing, engineers, designers, everyone. And everyone was supposed to do sales. So no one was allowed to do anything else and reaching out to people on LinkedIn and coming up with ideas and going to meetups and telling everyone about it. After 3 or 4 days, I realized that was a horrible idea because no one even got calls because, if you're an engineer, you're just not probably the best salesperson. Maybe I didn't train them. Maybe it was on me. But then I was basically on my own. So I did all the sales again. And by November 30th, we had the 10 clients that paid us and that grew more from there. And so I think that was my biggest success since we are on this B2B thing, that we basically thought, okay, either this company dies because no one seems to care what we are building, or we find a bunch of clients that pay us and then everything will be all right. It's still, of course, not everything is right, right? Because we have now 20 clients and some of them are converted to really long-term commitments, and we have the first 5-digit deals, and we're working on this first 6-digit deal on ACV that is still not signed, and so it takes time. But that moment for us was probably the best success that we had in the last couple of months.
Where were you able to change so fast that you went from literally 0 to 10?
Massive outreach, I would say, right? I went on my LinkedIn and I have 800 CEOs as connections, and probably I'm still not through it, by the way, but a couple of hundred of them got a message from me and said, hey, how What do you do in the learning space? Basically, like, hey, I have this new thing. I mean, I came up with like 15, 20 different pitches, and some of them work better and some of them didn't work. And we basically realized that who is the decision maker that really can make a decision, right? We would always target these L&D people, learning and development folks. And they oftentimes either don't have the budget or they don't have the authority to buy a product, or they are also oftentimes afraid of AI because we essentially also take away someone's job, right? Like if we come up with a product that creates all of the learning content automatically, you don't need all of the people that used to create the courses. And so people are afraid of that. And so we would basically just talk to the wrong person. And by going all the way from the top, it was probably easier to push it down. You still need the champion eventually that is being identified. And we have this with some of our partners as well, where the CEO or the founder is like really, really excited about what we are doing. But then ultimately the L&D person or whoever is supposed to do it doesn't do it because for whatever reason. But yeah, the biggest change was really like, who are we targeting in our outreach?
Okay. So founder-led sales.
Yes. Founder mode. Okay. Through and through.
Founder mode. Hashtag founder mode. Yeah. All right. The last question is about a hack. And it can be anything. It can be your personal one, how to make it work, how to make, what did you say, 6 to 6 work and then still be alive? Or, you know, anything that works for the company that you're willing to share with other founders.
Yeah, so I talked already about a bunch of company things that we did, like the trade show and how you send out those things. But I think I want to talk about longevity with you, at least for a little bit. And so, I turned 40 this year, and my wife will turn also 40 this year. And we both ask ourselves, like, how can we basically stay as healthy and as happy as we are right now? And there's this video that influenced us actually quite a bit from Brian Johnson. And he says something along the lines of, you know, if you ask any human that is healthy and somewhat young, like 30 to 50, do you want to live another day? Everyone probably says, yes, I want to live another day. Like, and so why do you not want to like keep your current body's shape, right? Like your health level, your energy at the same level as long as possible. And that's for me essentially the summary of longevity. It doesn't mean that you don't die. I think Brian Johnson takes it very far, obviously, that where he has this motto of don't die. But the whole idea is that you don't die from any like random thing. And so if you extend your fitness of what you have right now as long as possible, then that's really good for you. And so we made a few changes to our lives. And so one of the hacks that I did is that I changed my sleep pattern. So I historically have a very good sleep ability. Like, people are always a little jealous when I go into a plane and I fly from San Francisco to Frankfurt and I sleep basically 8 to 9 hours straight and don't even wake up once in an economy seat. So there are some hacks. There's an article on my LinkedIn profile also how you sit and what kind of tools you can use, or if anyone's interested, I'm happy to share those things. But my sleep would usually be like this, that I would come home from work around 6 or so, that I can, you know, spend time with my kids and my wife, and then at 9 or 10 p.m., everyone would be like down and go to sleep. And I would go back to work and work until my eyes fall asleep, like 12, 12:30, whatever, 1 o'clock. But I realized, and then because my kids wake up at, you know, 6:30 or 7. And so I didn't have as much sleep. And then also during the day, sometimes I would get tired. And I realized also that these last 2 hours of the day, I wasn't actually at my perfect abilities, because, you know, I would like drift off, fall asleep sometimes on the couch, wake up again, or I would fall asleep next to my son when I put him down to bed and I wake up again and I'm completely drowsy and I need to spend like an hour to get into like work mode again. And so what I changed now recently is that I go to bed at 10 p.m. And if I go to bed at 10 p.m., I can get up at 5 o'clock. So I get my good, you know, 7 hours of sleep, which is way more than I had before. And then I do have about 2 hours in the morning until my kids wake up, because they work, I mean, usually like 6:37 or so, but I basically have 2 hours by myself where I can really like focus and work. And especially because we have a lot of clients in Germany, I have a big overlap also to talk to them. And then I, you know, make them breakfast from 7 to 8, bring them to school, and I'm in the office by 8, and then I continue working to 6. So I always make this joke that I don't work from 9 to 9, but I work from 6 to 6. And that has been a huge life changer for me recently, especially because I have kids, right? Like this, not everyone has to do this, obviously, but just like really focusing on sleep and being healthy also through that is really essential for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think, yeah, I completely agree. It's not about just living longer, but it's living a good life, like a healthy life, and being like able to do stuff as long as possible.
Exactly. Yeah, and obviously there's more to it, right? Like how you exercise and what you eat and all of the things and what kind of green shakes I take in the morning. So there are many things you can do. And, you know, sometimes some people do more, some people do less. But I think it makes a lot of sense to think about this because and the main reason why it's so critical right now, in the moment of AI, we have this ability that probably in like 10, 20 years, a lot of these diseases that our parents or our grandparents died from, right? Like my father, for example, has Parkinson's. My grandmother had like Alzheimer's. And so those are diseases that will probably be cured with AI within the next 10 years. So why wouldn't we invest now in our body that we stay healthy until that moment happened so that we don't have to suffer from those and stay healthy for much longer? And so that's why I'm so excited about all of these longevity trends. And especially in San Francisco, it's so funny when I talk to friends back home, they're like, long what? It's not a word that is like really well known everywhere. Yeah. But here in San Francisco, it's like the dinner talk, right? Like everyone, like or alcohol, for example, like almost no one drinks alcohol anymore, which is so funny because this only changed, I would say, maybe in the last 2 years, but it's totally normal that you don't drink alcohol. And it's almost like weird if you drink alcohol.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, there is. Yeah.
So for
thing.
Your event here, think about alcohol-free options most. Yeah, no, you can still offer
Sorry,
it,
folks.
But no, I think you can still offer it. But you, I mean, I see this oftentimes where people come here like you, and they come from somewhere where this is not the trend, and then they're a little confused why everyone is kind of mad about the drink options. So it's like when you go to Hamburg, and at OMR is a lot of vegan food.
Beer.
No, we have beer there, but there's a lot of vegan. There's a lot of vegan food, and it's not very obvious to people from some places why that is not the thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We'll do, you know, because we're doing a brunch, and we'll do like kombucha and matcha, and then there will be like a little corner with the mimosas, and that's where you'll find me.
Yeah, I also, you know, I always say I drink at special occasions, but not just like every not like every day, you know. So
no, that would be too much. Yeah. All right, well, super cool. I think that's a good hack. It's like, you know, there is another saying: when you're healthy, you have hundreds of problems, but when you're sick, you just have this one problem. You want to get healthy. So yeah, let's adopt some good hack, good habit this week, this month. I don't know, start Monday. Anyway, thank you so much for sharing the story and sharing the hack and the, you know, the wins and failures. Looking forward to meeting again in person and now in San Francisco. And if you're a SaaS founder who wants to join us, then you know where to find us in May. Thank you so much, Christian.
Thank you so much, Anna. It was fun.
Cool. For me too. And take care.
Bye.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders. And if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS, but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.